Other than that, yeah, 2 years ago, they had their quadrilennial song festival every 4 years. Is that quadrilennial? Mm-hmm. Sounds good. And when the Soviets occupied Latvia, one of the ways the Latvian diaspora kept together were through song festivals. So every 4 years they'd have a song festival. They once had it in Maple Leaf Gardens. Mm-hmm. And they'd go to Australia, New York City, Toronto. And Toronto had, I think we were about 20,000 Latvians, three churches and summer camps. So I was raised in that kind of environment. Now the song festivals take place in Riga, and they have a special amphitheater just for the song festival in this big park. Mm. And it's a big amphitheater, a lot of levels, steps that people can sit on or stand on. And the song festival, the year I was there, the choir was 34,000 people. And the audience was 36,000. And the way they do it is 4 years before a committee decides on a songbook, and then that's distributed, or that songbook is printed and distributed to all the parishes in Latvia, the 250 parishes, and then to all the diaspora parishes. And then the different small choral groups practice, and they have the same songbook. And then for a week before the final concert, there are competitions. So the competitions are according to age, according to size of choir, and according to difficulty of the song sheets they're using. And then in the final, I saw it on TV, I didn't go there. But the final concert on the Sunday, I think they do groups of 10,000. I think they had three shifts. So very, very well organized. And then the final piece is when everyone comes on. The conductor stands on a podium which is raised two stories up on scaffolding in front and in the middle of the choir, so very visible. And so they'll sing a song, and then there'll be another conductor, so they keep changing conductors. It's very very moving. And then at the end, of course, they start to sing the oldies and goldies, which every Latvian kid knows. Then we do a lot of singing, and then everyone's singing, so all, what, 36 plus 34, that's 70, is it? 70,000 are singing and crying and all the rest of it. Very, very moving. And all the participants in the choirs have national costumes on, and each parish has their own distinctive costume, although they are of a kind of a genre. And so the women wear these long pleated skirts, highly embroidered, and usually white linen blouses, and quite often wear a crown or a wreath of flowers. Mm-hmm. And each parish is slightly different, so they're very beautiful. Anyway, back to the garden. So I'll just try to go through some of these questions, which is very helpful. Rinpoche, a teacher once told me that Theravada Buddhism is a path of punctuated gradualism. It's new. I haven't noticed much punctuation for the past 10 years. I feel like I understand the teaching and I have faith. Is this normal? I'm pulling my leg on this one. Also, is it normal I don't have a lot of questions? Oh, he's pretty good. Sounds like, yeah, I mean, if you have faith, that means you find the path that works, because I don't think you could sustain faith for 10 years if there wasn't some punctuation, or if it was all like spelling mistakes. So I do something must be happening to sustain effort for so long. Maybe it isn't like sentences from Samuel Beckett, but yeah, Samuel Beckett's first novel, Murphy. We'll go back to Murphy. There's just that first line. The sun shone, having no alternative, on the nothing new. It's total Becker. That's a digression. So I think you're doing fine. Also, is it normal not to have a lot of questions? Actually, yeah. I don't think the... If you get... Like if you get really, really into the complexities of Abhidhamma and the refinements of analysis, then you tend to have a lot of questions. Or if you are the type that takes Buddhism not as a reflective tool, but as a set of beliefs, then you get into questions of, is there karma, or how does karma work, and how does rebirth work, and you get into that kind of questioning, which isn't really the purpose of Buddhism, because the purpose of Buddhism is to reflect on the nature of consciousness and to help you be happy. So people who are not reflective, who like to believe in things, they quite often have questions. So, and they could be from traditional Buddhist countries. It's usually those kind of people ask about rebirth, and they ask every teacher they see the same question. And they get vaguely the same answer, and they ask the same question. And then every now and then you get the same one asking the same question. They forgot that they asked the same question last time. So you asked me that last time. But they're usually not reflective. They're believers. And then another word, I think, another kind of questioning comes when people are very, like they really like the intellectual side of it. They like the refinement of it. But I think contemplation, reflection is... It's something that you're using the teaching to look at yourself, and I think mostly you answer your own questions. And then the questions you do ask, I think are just like left, right, a little bit forward, a little bit back, and they're not so complex. That's what I find. So I was always the way my teachers, especially Ajahn Sumedho, he said, if you can't reflect on it, how can you really use it for liberation? So there's some things in Buddhism I can't reflect on, and I believe in. So rebirth, I have no kind of psychic capacities. But the way I've questioned myself with that one is I've said, okay, is consciousness just limited to the body? And that I don't believe. I don't know, but I do believe that consciousness is its own element. Okay, so that's my premise. And someone could argue that I'm wrong, I say, fine. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of basic to my understanding of life. And then, what is consciousness in other forms? I don't know. And then you have a kind of Buddhist way of presenting that. I said, okay, I'll use that as a working hypothesis. Good enough. But it's not kind of, I wouldn't, if they tortured me, I'd say, fine, I don't believe in rebirth, whatever. So it's that's a kind of reflective sense, isn't it? It's not like fundamental Buddhism. So if you are a reflective person, I think your intuitions are looking at how you're practicing, what's working, what's not working. I don't think there is that much. Not that it discourages questions. Same handwriting. By hanging on to guilt, and am I perpetuating the idea of a solid, separate self? For example, if I did something unskillful 20 years ago, perhaps it doesn't make sense to be feeling guilty about it today because the I who did it is not the same as the I of today. Of course, assuming I have made amends and so on. I think the importance of this is not so much a definition of an I, it's the recognition of memory as memory. Once you recognize memory as memory, then there is nothing to do, arises and ceases. So that's why when we're looking at stream of consciousness, we're letting go of our personal histories. When we're dealing with our personal histories, then we're dealing with the social consequences of what we've done. So we need to do that, but we don't need to do that for 20 years. Right? We don't need. So in stream of consciousness, one very important thing is this is just memory. Right? So feelings of guilt, they can still come up. It's not that they won't come up, but you know them as memory. So the one memory I like to talk about is I was on a motorbike with a person in the back. I was 17 years old. I passed 5 cars. Very dangerous, crazy thing to do. And I just squeaked in, and I still get that memory sometimes. Right? It's not a guilt memory, but it's still a strong memory of something quite foolish, foolhardy. And just to think, wow, I survived. Yeah, this is when I was 17 years, 50 years ago. So memories, depending on the intensity of the experience, can have a long, long echo in our minds, which is fine, which is just normal. But then the additions to it, picking it up with a sense of self, that we don't need to do. And that's the challenge of forgiveness, making amends, and all of that. But just to see memory is memory. And then if it's a very painful memory, if I've done something very, very... sometimes the perception is just wrong. I think I've done something cruel and actually wasn't that bad. And then over 20 years' time, I've just proliferated on the memory, right? And always just pick this perception which I have and I've created this massive thing. So we don't even know. We know we're not in the accuracy of a memory. But in any case, not to think that there isn't a result of memory coming into mind, but to just process it through bodily feeling rather than through thought. And because the thought is just, it's really uncertain, especially after so many years. So it's not, you don't kind of analyze these things back, because then you're still in thought. The trick is just not to think about it. Just refuse to think about it. Feel it, recognize it, but just don't think about it. No. No. And that takes samadhi. So one of the things in, I think, like today I suggested, just take that theme, present moment. So tomorrow just take, refuse to think. Combine those two now. Now that, in our culture, that might, you might think, well, that's repressive. It's not. It's just refusing to think. I think our culture thinks that then we need to think. And hence, we need to think that we're, why are we thinking that we're thinking? And but just try it. Just try to refuse to think. And that takes a very, and it strengthens present moment awareness. If there's material that's coming up, you'll still feel it. You know, if I have some guilt, or it'll still come up, even though I don't think about it, but it'll be a kind of pressure in the body. So that's an interesting one. Just refuse to think about it. But if the habit's been to think about it, mull it over like a loose tooth for 20 years, then it'll be hard. Because that's been the kind of linkage. Memory comes up, oh, am I really through this? Have I made amends? Oh, gosh. And if that's been going on for 20 years, it's going to take some vigor to not go down that pathway. And the mind's been kind of programmed that way. Could you please speak more about overcoming fear patterns? Besides not avoiding the things I'm afraid of, that's driving in the snow, and being mindful of the body sensations that the activity brings up, is there more I can do? Don't think about it. And I really, really, so my experience is, like, I wasn't a fearful person in terms of adventure. I could do adventure on my own, travel a while in the world and so on. But when it came to people, there was a lot of fear. Talking, giving talks. And so I just learned not to plan the talk. But I still felt the fear. So my thinking mind would want to go to the planning of the talk, and that was never successful. I realized that. And then I would say, no, don't think about it. Where is it? So the refusal to think was not a repression of the emotion. The refusal was to think was just actually seeing the fear in a much more direct way, as a direct perception rather than as a... Because thought is always one step removed or two steps removed from the direct perception, isn't it? The direct experience. The description of a flower is never... Or a leaf is never that. The experience of a leaf, is it? So the same way with an emotion. So I found by going to it directly, I saw that I wasn't feeling it. But there are some fears which are really biological, like driving in the snow, or shaking hands with a bear when you see him on the path. Right? You just don't do it. So there's biological fear, but the psychological fears that we have, I think for me, when I could, I found that when they were stimulated in ways which were doable, like I could be aware of them, it was very helpful because it was like a purification. And each time fear has come up and I can be aware of it, then I've felt more and more, great, this is the chance now to not feel it with thought and self-view, but just to let it go through my body and let this karma end finally. Let this terrible self-imagery that made me shy, whatever, let it end, let it finally end, and by feeling it, okay, let's have it. And I found that, I didn't realize that in the beginning, because I was just so hopeless, but then more and more, if it gets triggered, it doesn't get triggered much. Sometimes it does. I thought it would get triggered at my brother's wedding, my nephew's wedding. I had to give a little talk, and boy, was I proliferating on that. Oh, God. Everyone's going to have a suit on, and I got to wear this thing. But actually, it's not a problem. I was surprised. I really thought I'd be nervous. I quite enjoyed it. So that was just my proliferating mind thinking I would have fear. So I watched that. So thought is very, very important to learn how to not think. It's not repressive. It's samadhi. And you really have to be very much in the present moment as the thinking mind starts to kind of rev up. If a person was somehow disassociate or whatever, psychiatric terms, then I'm sure there'd be a different way of dealing with that. So I'm not aware, I don't have the experience of that, where talking would maybe make something conscious. But once it's conscious, my experience is to have it, get the direct perception, and then it will. Why the resistance of the mind to be in the present moment? I would say it's habit. I wouldn't say it's so much resistance, it's more habit. That makes sense to me, because that's what has been going on with the thinking mind. And then those habits, you could see, they're steeped in fear and desire. So anticipation of some beautiful event, or anticipation of some troublesome event, or fear of failure, or fear of destruction. And you could see how, those are very primal energies we have. And if I have followed those energies for many years in that particular way, then it'd be very hard to be in the present moment, because they would be governing consciousness. So each time something triggered those patterns, and off it would go. So the training of the mind, I wouldn't see it so much a resistance to the present moment, it's just a habit not to be in the present moment. Maybe. But resistance is okay, whatever word you want. So that's what we're dealing with. And the habit is what accumulated consequences of the way we've thought and acted, karma. Vipaka karma. Karma means intentional action, vipaka karma means the results of that. Could you please cite the reference for the quote? Oh, I can give you that tomorrow, Emily. I'll have it in that book. Shinzen Young says, pain times resistance equals suffering. Pain plus equanimity equals spiritual growth. Okay. Besides that, please remind us of the benefits of sitting through physical pain. I find it hard to remember when my back aches during a sit. Thanks. If it's really bad, just go up to your room and lay down. All right, so don't hurt yourself. But there is a kind of strength in being with dukkha vedana. And dukkha vedana is the unpleasantness of the physical body or any kind of physical sensation. Because in dukkha vedana, craving arises to get out of it. Now, if I can bear witness to dukkha vedana, to unpleasant sensations, and look at the desire not to have that, that can lead to equanimity. So it can be a real strengthening of the capacity to be equanimous. And we just have quite a lot of dukkha vedana in being human, both in our social interactions, the emotions we feel, the bodily feelings we have. It's a big part of sense consciousness. So it's profitable in that way if one can look at it from a sense of mindfulness and composure and understand the flow of consciousness as that and see how even within dukkha vedana it's possible to be equanimous and peaceful. And that, I think, is an important lesson. I know Ajahn Sumedho has, like he's told me, he'll go to the dentist and he'll get the drill without the Novocaine or whatever they give you, just to do that exercise. And he listens to the sound of silence. So he's got the high power drill, and he's got the sound of silence. And he uses that as an exercise to remain empty within physical pain. Now that sounds like self-mortification, sounds like it's off the path, but he's mindful enough that he knows he's not just torturing himself. So that sounds like a very extreme exercise, but it's the indication of a strong practitioner and takes something difficult on. But like just having pain day in, day out on a meditation, it just starts to wear you down. You just start to get really, really, really tired. So then you just have to find a posture where you don't have so much pain. Because you're not made to take so much pain, really. So then, like, try to find a posture where you can be in a posture for longish periods of time so it doesn't hurt so much. I don't want people to lie down here because it would be sort of inappropriate in from my Orthodox tradition. But, you know, if during the sitting it's just like just a hassle, go up and see if you can develop the lying meditation on your bed. See if you can keep the mind alert and bright. Or try to do the standing posture, or do some walking in the hallway. Just try to change the posture, something which isn't so difficult. But the question, why would you do that? Well, I think you'd do it if you saw the chance to actually investigate dukkha vedana and abide in equanimity. And then obviously, when the dying comes, then there's this massive resource of equanimity with all that nastiness with which death brings us. You spoke about doctor-assisted suicide. Currently, when someone is in hospital and death is imminent, a doctor can administer extra pain medication which hastens death, thus causing less suffering. From a Buddhist perspective, is this compassion or a violation of the first precept? Very difficult question. If I were to recommend to a doctor, the way the precepts are laid out, it's like, the first precept is not to kill. The way the Vinaya is laid out for the monks is much more stringent. So if I were to recommend to a doctor, let's say you have a Buddhist doctor, and he says, can I overdose this person to end their suffering? If I said yes, that's okay. And he did it, and the person died because of that, and the doctor did it because of my recommendation, I would no longer be a monk. I'm disqualified from being a monk. So we were very careful about that. Any recommendation to terminate a life would be, would be what we call a paragraphic rule or a defeat rule. So, what to do? What to do? Well, if I guess the terminology, if the application of the medication was to relieve the physical suffering, that was the intention, and then the person died, the intention wasn't to terminate the life, I guess that would be in line with the first precept. But I don't want to be the guy that calls this. You know, I'm not the Pope, right? I don't want to be the guy that tells everyone, well, as a Buddhist monk, because I don't know. But I can just tell you what my precept structures are, and then you have to kind of figure it out in the situations that arise. So, say with my mom, that never really arose. That question never really arose. It's difficult. It's really, really difficult. Now, I've contemplated like this, it's in a Supreme Court now, the doctor-assisted suicide, and I thought, well, I'd like the choice. I'd like to be able to make that choice myself, but I wouldn't want to put someone else in the position of having to do that. So I got, you know, I faced a dilemma. So if I'm asking someone, you know, to terminate my life quickly, then I put the person who's going to do it, according to my precept structure, in a bind. So I don't, you know, again, it's not so easy. It's not such an easy thing. But I think it's important to think about it for each of us, so that when it comes, at least we've contemplated it and thought about it. And not easy. So, from a Buddhist perspective, is this compassion or a violation of the first precept? It could be both. You know, it could be coming from a compassionate place, but it could be a violation of the first precept. I don't know. Pets. You know, pets are, you know, they're suffering. We had a very interesting thing in our monastery in New Zealand. When Ajahn Kusala came to the monastery way back when he was a layman, he had a cat called Yeti, because it had six toes. Bigfoot, Yeti. And this cat had the best life. Such a good life. And anyway, it was very, very old, and the monks were taking care of it. It had its own heat. We bought a special heater for it. And I wasn't there, but Yeti was very old, and a layperson, we don't know who, saw it was happening and phoned the RSPCA and said that we are unnecessarily keeping this animal alive, which is cruel. So the RSPCA came and killed it. You know, that's so. But again, people ask me about that, so I don't know, it's the karma of having pets. Your problem. Right? So I think it's important to realize that monks can talk about what the Buddha taught, but in a Buddhist world, everyone has their own ethical dilemmas. And it's not like, it's not so cut and dry, this is evil, right? I mean, it's such a mixture of things going on. Obviously, it's, you know, to karmically, I would think it's karmically heavier to shoot a deer. I don't know. Actually, when I think about that, I don't know. I don't know how it works. So there you get a befuddled answer. But just be very mindful. And whatever decision you make, and say whatever the consequences are, I'll take them. So, regarding setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma, I understood that the Dhamma simply is, and it is, and is not subject to arising or ceasing. Is it not correct that even if the Dhamma had not been penetrated by the Buddha, it would still be the Dhamma? Yes, true. So what is meant by setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma, the Four Noble Truths? Truth is always truth. But the particular formulation that the Buddha offers for the realization of Nibbana, Nibbana isn't a discovery, it's a rediscovery. Say, it's not something invented or new, non-attachment, non-grasping, and so on. And the particular formulation that Gautama Buddha offers, the Four Noble Truths, is what we mean by setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma. But the truth is always the truth. And that's why probably different beings discover it in different, through different yoga paths, I suppose you could say. In the discourse on the characteristic of not-self, I don't understand why that which is impermanent is only painful and never pleasurable. Cannot the clinging phenomena of the world be painful, pleasurable, or neutral? I thought attachment was the problem, the non-understanding of impermanence, not the things themselves. A good question. I've been thinking about that translation, and I've been thinking the translation would be more correct if we said it has the characteristic of dukkha rather than the vedana of dukkha. And so I was describing that all phenomena have the characteristics of dukkha. So the Pali word is dukkha. Then we get the English translation, it is painful, right? So I was thinking, I would read better for me if it said dukkha lakkhana. Yeah, even pleasure has dukkha lakkhana because I get attached to pleasure and I try to get rid of pain. But it's true, it's about attachment. So I thought attachment was the problem, the non-understanding of impermanence, not the things themselves. Yeah, it's very true, that's very true. So, I don't know who does the translations, but I'll write to them. Thank you for the questions, by the way. Mm-hmm. You said that sati is mindfulness imbued with wisdom. How would you convey the wisdom aspect to people just beginning to meditate who have no background in Buddhism? I would use the analogy of gravity. You know, not only are you mindful of being on the roof, you're also mindful of the law of gravity and the consequences of falling off. When you turn on the ignition in the car, you're not only aware of the car, but you're also aware of the consequences if you're not careful, you run someone over, and speeding and all the rest of it. So the kind of consequential nature of action and the consequential nature of being heedless. So when you're being heedless, it's not just about spilling the sugar on the floor because you're careless, it's also about the consequences of acting and speaking and thinking in ways which are heedless, which then have repercussions in your mind. So in that kind of larger sense. So the word we tend to use is sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension. We see that a lot. And I think we all see that as we practice Dhamma and we have our own insights about who we are and how we suffer and how we free our minds from suffering, that sati becomes imbued more and more deeply with wisdom, doesn't it? You know, we think about when we first started to kind of be aware to life when we were adolescents or whatever, there wasn't maybe that much insight yet. Now, through the travails of life's experiences, the sati isn't just about being present. It's being present through the Dharma, through understanding. I don't think I've ever met a radiant person. Well, what about me?
No ego there.
Did I shave? If you know any currently. See that egg, look. If you know any currently, could you invite him or her to Tisarana so we could all meet? Yeah. A monastery full of them. All right, so. Or do you know where we might go to find sati saraniya? I suppose they're rare. Well, it takes one to know one, maybe. Especially in these parts. What do you mean? What's wrong with Canada? Come on. How would you describe such a person? They have four heads. Why aren't there more of them? Let me set that one up, by the way. Why don't you reflect further on rebirth? Both historically in the teachings and in the context of current day life. I have a hard time believing in and relating to understanding rebirth. Yeah, that's a very easy one from a traditional rebirth society. And you know, like Thailand or Sri Lanka, that is so, it's such common coinage in the way their worldview. It's just someone dies an early death. They say, yeah, it's probably their karma. And it's just, that's the way they develop upekkha. It's probably their karma. For us, we tend to have a kind of one lifetime philosophy. We see consciousness as being a phenomenon of material body, and we've been very much educated that way, and so we have a cultural bias oftentimes against rebirth, whereas the Thais and Sri Lankans and Indians and some South American cultures and lots of other cultures have a bias for rebirth. So one interesting thing this is that we are very culturally conditioned in our worldviews. We think that they're correct, that they're so close to us, they've been so formulated in as we grew up, that we don't see it as actually a cultural perspective, we see it as truth. And that's a kind of honesty when we say to ourselves, I have difficulty in relating to it. And I think that's very good, because that's all we can really do. For me to say, you know, to practice Buddhism, you have to believe in rebirth. Some people will say that, but I don't think it's necessary. But it does create difficulties when you start to read the suttas and you start to read about, you know, the karmic formations are not just this lifetime. The things come to us from previous energies and so on. So you could try that. One good way to try that. You say, well, what if that was true? Which is a really, this is like the working hypothesis idea. So what if that were true? Rather than saying I believe it or I don't believe it, so then you challenge your whole mindset to think in a different way without refusing the mindset you prefer. You're not refusing it. You say, well, okay. And that's a hard exercise. That's a hard exercise to do, is to put yourself into another mindset, because we tend to be comfortable with this mindset. You know, we're of a certain age, and I feel comfortable in that mindset. So there's a kind of sort of intellectual, existential challenge to think in a completely new way. And then if you go through the exercise, then you might see, well, what would the consequences of that mean in what I do? What would the consequences of that be about my mom dying? What would the consequences of that be in my own death? If you get into speculative thought about, okay, what happens then? You know, do I get reborn as a turnip, or, you know, or as a turtle, or as an arahant, or what happens to me? Then that becomes a very impossible exercise, because the teaching says that the complexity of rebirth is so complex, the ordinary human mind can't grasp it. Our intellect is limited by that. So it's an article of faith, unless you have psychic abilities, and some people seem to have psychic abilities. So I would first of all, as a dharma, just watch what happens when a part of the teaching hits you in a way that you find difficult to believe, and just see, oh, this is disbelief. This is the karma. This is what disbelief feels like, and don't feel obliged that you have to believe it. Just allow that doubtful state of mind. That's natural too. That's fine. Because then you'll see, oh yeah, then you're back in the Dharma, that with this condition, disbelief comes up. And then you don't feel guilty about it, or resist it, or fight it, or you just say, oh, my mind doesn't go there. Oh, that's what, and that will cease. So the disbelief arises, stays for a while, and ceases. and something else you believe in. And that's the way you can practice in stream of consciousness, can't you? Belief, disbelief. So there's a lot in the you know, like in the suttas that, it's really hard, really kind of difficult to get my head around. And oftentimes I just leave it alone, don't make it a problem. If I thought I had to kind of believe everything, then I could get really stuck in something. So what about this or what about this? But I'm a pragmatist and I think, well, so far it's worked. You know, I'm going to just take the bits that really work and go for it. So I have a faith in the Buddha's enlightenment and it's been effective so far. Can't fault it. The lifestyle's been. So then, you know, from that kind of experience, I say, well, if that's true, yeah, maybe the rest is, a lot of it's true too, that I don't know. But it's not a huge thing. For me, it's not a huge thing. Now, when you go to Thailand, there's a lot of talk of monks who have psychic powers and can see how beings are reborn, and so you have a whole culture which goes to this. You know, there's always the psychic monks in the Wat Bapong Sangha, in the Yajahn Chah Sangha. Everyone knows who the psychic monks are, and you know, people are going to them and asking them rebirth questions. And I'm tempted to also, because, well, yeah, let's find out where Mom went. But I've resisted that. I don't know. So, like, so with my mom, with my mother's passing, first of all, my basic gut felt instinct is that rebirth does take place, because I don't think consciousness is a physical phenomenon. So from that, then I speculate, well, Mom was a really good person. She was very moral, very generous, very kind, reflective person. She's doing great. So, you know, that's how I deal with it. And if it's not true, well, then that's all right too. That's all right too, I don't know. But I certainly can see how the law of karma works right now. You know, I can see that because I've lived a fairly skillful life, I don't have a lot of remorse or regret. So the mind has a lot of clarity. I can see because I've lived a moral and generous life, I've got generous friends, take care of me, and help me. So it all works at that level. So that's enough. You know, if death comes and there's the big black hole, I won't know about it. Mm-hmm. Right? But I am curious about death. And I'm certainly curious what happens to awareness when the khandhas fall away. Very curious. Very curious, yeah. And is there a restructuring of the self through craving? That's, you know, that, I think that's going to be the TV show I'll be watching. Don't do it!